I'm very good at this. I don't know why.
No, it's not about you. It's not like you can be a great coach. You can't make the player better.
Episode 37 of There Is No Offseason, a podcast from Baseball Prospectus focusing solely on Fantasy Keeper and Dynasty League formats. I am your host, Ben Carsley, and I am joined by BP's fantasy manager and the world's foremost Kyle Schwarber apologist, Brett Sayer, and my fellow authors, a dude who's about to be murked by the next great polar vortex, Mauricio Rubio, and the man who's as cold on GChat as he is IRL, Craig Goldstein. Good evening, guys. Nice to have everyone back together. Say hi to everyone and tell them where they can find you on the interwebs. And Brett, let's start with you.
You can find me at baseballprospectus.com and thedynastyguru.com and on Twitter at dynastyguru. Mal?
You can find me at Baseball Prospectus and you can find me on Twitter at mrubio52. Craig?
You can find me at Baseball Prospectus, at the Dynasty Guru, and at SB Nation's MLB News Desk. And you can find me on Twitter at CD Goldstein. That's CD as in clandestine decanter, Goldstein. Ben?
Not what those words mean. You can also find me at Baseball Prospectus and the Dynasty Guru, and you can find me on Twitter at Ben Carsley. You can find this podcast on Twitter via the aptly named at Tino Podcast handle, and you can ask us questions and talk to us about your feelings by emailing us at tinopodcast@gmail.com. Change it up that time now. All right, I'm happy to announce that we actually have some structure once again tonight, which is pretty big news for us, and that's because the Fantasy Positional Series is underway at BP. Because it's the first week, that means we're going to tell you more than you ever really needed to know about catchers. So with that in mind, we're going to discuss Brett's Dynasty Catcher rankings in a little bit, and we're going to get into his top 50 rankings of newly eligible Dynasty players a little later on, too. But first, we're going to start the show off a bit differently this week, and we're going to do reader emails first. And our first reader email comes from Joseph. Joseph says, "Thou dignified Dukes of Dynasty Baseball and your handy serf, Craig. I'm in a 10-team league that is expanding to 13 teams this offseason. I'm very pleased that we'll be able to deepen our league and make it a bigger challenge to compete in this year, but now I have a decision to make. As part of the expansion, there is obviously an expansion draft. I'm torn on three final slots for my protection list. The league scoring switches OBP and slugging for average and quality starts for wins. Which three of these players would you protect for best long-term value? Those players are Alcides Escobar, Charlie Blackmon, Desmond Jennings, Arizmendi Alcantara, Lorenzo Cain, Ian Kennedy, and Shelby Miller. Thanks, and sincerely, Joe from Minneapolis, whose phone was in German that one time." Oh, Joe, now we know you. This is good. Okay, so Craig, in the interest of doing things a little bit differently this week, why don't you lead off and take this question first?
Sure. I think the three guys I would take, I mean, off the bat, I would keep Shelby Miller for long-term value, and I would also probably keep Lorenzo Cain, although the outfield reserves kind of a lot to choose from. I was originally waffling between Desmond Jennings and Arizmendi Alcantara, or Alcantara. I'll get that one time, I swear. But I think I would actually go with Arizmendi. Jennings just does not have the same type of power that I kind of expected he would have. He only had 10 home runs last year. He's still useful. But Arizmendi had the same number of home runs in 200-something less fewer at-bats. And, he stole fewer bases. I think over the course of the season, they're probably going to end up around the same. And I think long-term, this is dangerous to do, but long-term, the Cubs lineup could be really really good. And if Alcantara is hitting at the top of that lineup, he's going to score a ton of runs. I think Escobar is the guy that really does not fit in this equation, and I'd throw him back immediately. I mean, I understand you're going from 10 teams to 13, but even in a 13-team league, I don't think Escobar is like a definite keeper, depending on how many people you end up holding on to. But I don't know, Brett, do you have another take on it?
I do. We're going to get into the same discussion that we got into by the last episode or the episode before. I agree that Shelby Miller is a no-brainer. I also kind of think Charlie Blackman's a no-brainer here also. I would keep him in, considering the depth of the league. He's going to be the best guy in 2015 of possibly this entire group, depending on what Shelby Miller does. So I would keep Miller, Blackman, and then it really is a step back. But because it's a OBP and slugging league, that kind of devalues Kane a little bit. It devalues Alcantara a little bit, but not nearly as much because he has more power and he's actually got sneaky slugging ability. He doesn't have he's got some over the fence pop, but he's got extra base pop as well. So I would take Shelby, Charlie Blackman, and Alcantara. Ben.
I just want to defend all of us for a second. We said Alcantara for so many years that there's just little chance of me ever not going there immediately before we ever actually heard
really
it announced anywhere. I know, but I just don't. I mean, listen to how much trouble mostly me, but at certain points all of us have saying player names that we've heard before. It doesn't bode well.
It's tough. It's really hard to
retrain
your brain.
I mean, we're not going to do it, but I'm –
he doesn't spell it correctly either, if that's how you want it to be pronounced. Because
there's an accent there.
Well, yeah, I can't. People are generally too lazy to type that.
Yeah.
This is America. So. All right. I won't really. Shelby Miller, for me, is the most obvious pick. And then, because this is long term, I'm also going Alcantara. The Charlie Blackman, Lorenzo Cain, Desmond Jennings debate. I really wanted to say Desmond Jennings, but he's one of those guys that always feels better to me than he actually is. You know, we're not so far removed. He did hit 14 homers and still 20 bases in 2013, but the average really isn't anything special. So I'm actually inclined to agree with Brett that Blackman is probably who I'd keep here, but I'm not really thrilled about it. So Miller and Alcantara, definitely. Blackman, Jennings, Kane, even Kennedy, if you're really desperate for pitching. Well, I guess not, because if Kennedy goes anywhere basically other than Safeco or Seattle, he's not going to be as useful. But
yeah, that's why I didn't say Kennedy, because he's 1 year in Petco, and it might not be, you know, if he ends up somewhere that's not friendly to fly balls, it's a real problem.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, gun to my head, Blackman, but I don't love it. Mal?
Yeah, I have the same list as Brett. I really wanted to have the Blackman versus Lorenzo Cain fight, but I can't really give it to Cain because of, you know, Blackman's park helps him out quite a bit, and you know, they had the same amount of stolen bases last year. Blackman got caught a little bit more; he was less efficient on the base paths, but you know, he's got an edge in slugging, and you know, considering the league format, I kind of have to go with Blackman. Arismendi, on top of everything that you guys said, positional flexibility is a big deal too. So.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, being able to pick up that second base eligibility, that's going to help. So, and I think he's going to be able to keep it over the long term because I think that's the type of skill set that he has. So, and, you know, that might be what the Cubs have in mind for him, just to kind of, you know, play him all over the field and let him pick up all sorts of nice, juicy eligibility. So, Arismendi, Charlie Blackman, and Shelby Miller, because I still heart Shelby.
Yeah, I would also just say, like, I wasn't trying to dismiss Blackman out of that group. I was saying I thought all four of those outfielders are kind of grouped together. I think it's tough to pick, although, like I said, I would probably take Kane. I understand Blackman was fine from June on, but I don't know if he's that player from that point on, if they don't try and improve upon him at some point. But that so that's I have playing time concerns, especially long term with Blackman. But I do think he's a fine option if you were leaning that way or something like that in the you know already.
Oh yeah, so, I mean I could definitely see the dings against Blackman. I mean there's going to be always concerns you know in regards to playing time and what you can upgrade over in cores. But yeah, you're right. I mean it's just it's
yeah,
the, you know, these margins
really
of thin.
Against lefties.
Yeah. He's terrible.
He's no Corey Dickerson, but. he'll have to do for a little while.
Yeah,
no, and I think he's fine. I thought they were all close together.
All right, Charlie Blackman is becoming our new Austin Meadows, so I am going to move us along here. And we will go to the second reader email of the week, and this comes from Liam. Liam says, "Hi, guys. I'm a longtime listener and Dynasty Guru reader from Canada. Your colorful debate always livens up the fantasy baseball offseason. After your discussion of Mookie Betts on a recent episode, I traded away Gregory Polanco for Mookie Betts and Jose Peraza, a move that might help me win a championship or two in the near future. I am in a 12-team Dynasty Keeper League that uses wins, strikeouts, shutouts, ERA, and whip." Ugh, shutouts. "My team is built to win now, and my offense is strong enough that I equally care about my chances of winning in, I'm assuming he means 2015, 2016, my main weakness is my rotation. My quote-unquote no-brainer rotation keepers are Yu Darvish, Jordan Zimmermann, Jose Fernandez, and Carlos Carrasco. Beyond them, I can only keep three of the following six players. Matt Shoemaker, Cliff Lee, Brandon McCarthy, Matt Latos, Hyunjin Ryu, and James Paxton. If Cliff Lee and Latos are healthy, I'm keeping both, but that is a big if. So I ask you, is Cliff Lee's upside when healthy, still high enough to gamble on him in 2015. Same question about Matt Latos when compared to the rest of this list. Or am I wiser to cut ties with Lee and or Latos and instead keep players whose ceilings aren't as high but who may be more reliable and stay on the field and produce? Please help me pick the best three. Thanks in advance, Liam." So I'm very confused by this question because it keeps referencing 2014 as though 2014 is the next season. And if that's what Liam is planning for, I'm very, very concerned about his team. But we'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Numbers are very tricky. It's a Monday, not for him, but, you know, it's fine. We'll get it done.
To be fair, I don't think 2015 is going to come to Canada until 2016.
Oh, good point. Good point.
That's the way healthcare works up there. That's true.
Good, yeah.
Okay. So, Mal, dissect these six options for us. Do three of them stand out? Would you be dropping any of his no-doubt keepers for one of these guys? Maybe Carrasco? I'm not sure if everyone would be convinced he's the definite next choice. Tell us how you break this down.
I'm gonna be honest with you. Even, you know, you mentioned Cliff Lee and Matt Latos' health concerns. I mean, you got concerns all up and down the back half of your keepers here. Those guys are definitely like the no-doubters for me. Cliff Lee and Matt Latos go up there. I'm dropping Carlos Carrasco off of there. Then I'm keeping Ryu. And I, you know, between Shoemaker, McCarthy, and Paxton, I might keep McCarthy, but I can kind of see the case for the back half of those two guys. But, I'm not in love with Carlos Carrasco all that much. I think, you know, Darvish, Zimmermann, and Jose Fernandez can gives you a little bit of leeway. Well, not so much Fernandez, but, you know, Darvish and Zimmermann give you a little bit of leeway in what you can do and the type of gambles that you can take. I mean, I think Lee and Latos are still guys that you absolutely want to keep, just given their upside and the pedigree and what they can bring to the table, you know, despite all of the injury concerns that you have. They're legitimate concerns, but, you know, by the same token, there's just not a whole lot on the back half of this list that, you know, is very sturdy. I mean, Ryu had some injury concerns last year. He had shoulder fatigue and shoulder issues earlier in the season. McCarthy's, you never really know with him. I think Shoemaker and Paxton are two pretty big unknowns. So, to tidy it all up, I'm dropping Carrasco. I'll go Cliff Lee, Matt Latos, McCarthy, and Ryu. Craig?
I don't think I'd be keeping Cliff Lee in this situation. I think grouping his health issues with a guy like Latos is a little misleading because Latos, I mean, I understand he missed substantial time last year, but he also produced even with decreased stuff, and he produced pretty well. And he's now in an even better park, which, well, that didn't, his home park didn't hurt him as much as you might think. It's obviously a good thing. I do think I would go with Ryu and McCarthy for sure. And I'd probably keep James Paxton over a guy. Or I guess that's four people, so that's not going to work.
You can drop Carrasco.
Yeah, well, I mean, I like Carrasco. I guess I would definitely keep Latos. I would keep Ryu, and then I would probably choose two out of three from Carrasco, McCarthy, and Paxton. Paxton has his own health issues, but man, has he been good when he does pitch. I'd be tempted to go for upside in a 12-team Dynasty League. I guess it depends how big the rosters are. But I do think, you know, I do think Cliff Lee's health is a real risk going forward. I think you can, you know, Matt Shoemaker was a great story, but I think you can find Matt Shoemaker's. I'd be tempted to go with Latos, Ryu, and Paxton. And as much as I like McCarthy, and I think he can get a bunch of wins in LA, I think you can find guys like him, especially in terms of strikeouts, et cetera. And he's a health risk of his own. So, I mean, you've got a lot of health risk overall here, but I would go with Latos, Ryu, and Paxton. Ben?
Yeah, damn it, Craig. I'm going Latos, Ryu, and Paxton. I don't love Carrasco as much as some people do, but I can't drop him for McCarthy, Lee, or Shoemaker, especially Shoemaker, who, Craig, like you said, he's a dime a dozen, especially in a 12-team league. Lee... You can't. I'm not going to own Cliff Lee in any leagues next year unless he's like the last pick of my draft. And McCarthy is somehow like the most brittle of everyone on this list, other than Lee, which is very impressive given the names on this list. So, yeah. So Latos for you and Paxton. You're either going to like. It wouldn't be surprising if this is the best rotation in your league, or if like four out of these seven guys get hurt and you're wishing you had Matt Shoemaker. So you have a very high variance rotation. Just be warned. I'm sorry, but again, healthcare in Canada, maybe you can take care of that. Who hasn't gone? Brett hasn't gone.
Brett.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to this. There's a lot of risk here. I'd probably keep Cliff Lee over Paxton, but it's pretty close. And I would keep Carrasco in a 12-teamer just because if he sucks, you can find someone else. But if he's good, he's going to be very good. So,
hey, you know,
yeah, the strikeout upside with him is bananas.
You can also probably drop him for Matt Shoemaker if you play your cards right.
You absolutely could. Yep. There's always pitching available in 12 team leagues. Always.
Fair enough. Okay, well, that was not a rare moment of unity, but pretty good solidarity there. We'll move on to the third question from Simon. Simon says, love the pod. I'm in a 12-team AL.
Wait. Is that for real?
Is what for real?
Simon says.
He does. His name is Simon. Grow up.
Okay.
You think the man's never heard that before?
I'm just saying.
Cracking what if we Simon just go with Simon Writes?
Yes.
What if we just called him Simone?
Simon, yeah, no. let's do that. I'm with that. I'm going to call him Simon. Simon Martin.
This guy's also from Toronto. What? We global, I guess. Got a guy right.
So it might be German. Martin. Simon Martin. Could be French-Canadian.
That's a very good name.
All right, S-Mart writes, love the pod. I'm in a 12-team AL-only league where we get to keep 7 players, 14 hitters, and 9 pitchers. What? What? What does that mean?
The league, the rosters are 14 hitters.
That's the roster choice, yeah.
I was quite, I was like, I think maybe those latter two fit under the first umbrella. Okay, thank you. It seems hitting is always at a premium in this format. I'm interested what your philosophy is in a mono league in regards to the split of your keepers between hitting and pitching. What do you do in a league that inflates hitting more than pitching? Do you load up on bargain pitchers or join the fray to overpay hitting? I like to have 5 hitters and 2 pitchers, but have gone 4 hitters to 3 pitchers and 6-1 before. I managed to cobble together a good list in a semi-rebuild last year. I definitely am going to keep Springer for $5, Betts for $5, Dozier for $9, Kluber for $13, and Doolittle for $5. Filling out my last 2 keeper spots is where I'm having doubts. Which 2 would you take? Abreu for 28, Machado for 10, Jose Ramirez for 5, Garrett Richards for 5. The knee gods weren't kind to me in August. Simon. Apparently that your name is Simon now. I'm sorry. I did like the line about the knee gods not being kind to him. That's a pretty brutal back half of the keeper list there. But this is pretty interesting. I think we've discussed hitting and pitching in the breakdown before, so we can get into that if you want, or you know, I think we've covered it. So Brett, maybe instead of just giving you all the different ways you could answer this question, I'll let you answer the question.
Okay. So we'll start general really quick. We have talked about it before, but when you're figuring out your keepers, you keep value. You don't worry about positions. It doesn't matter whether you have six hitters and one pitcher, or four hitters and three pitchers. You keep the most value when you can, and you also do take into account what your league's tendencies are. I mean, if you've been in the league long enough, you know that teams spend a little bit more on offense, then you should go in with your bid limits slightly higher on offense to compensate for that. But moving to the actual players, I think that I really am tempted to say Machado and Richards, and then just take that savings and spend whatever you have to spend to get Abreu back and keep that. But I might actually, I'm tempted to sub one of them in for Doolittle. I really like all three of their values, especially if there's a lot of inflation on hitters. I think you can get closers. You can get them for probably $10 to $12. You probably won't get Sean Doolittle for $10 to $12, but you could get somebody. Saves are saves, as always. That's my final decision. Get rid of Doolittle, keep Abreu, Machado, and Richards. And Craig?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no way you let Abreu go back into that pool. You're talking about a 12-team AL only. I mean, I don't know that I let Abreu go unless I have him for over $40. Because he's talking about, like, a league that has inflation for hitters. I mean, you could justify $40 for Abreu in a 12-team AL only right off the bat, I think. So I would definitely be keeping Abreu for that. I would also want to keep Machado and Richards. And I guess Doolittle's probably the guy I would throw back. I would say you could potentially sell high on a guy like Dozier, who was a little bit of a late bloomer. But, I mean, 2020 guys at that position don't come around very often. So I get why you'd want to keep him. But perhaps you can trade him and get someone even better than the guys that you're listing out here. But otherwise, I'd do what Brett said. Ben?
Strong agree on Abreu and Machado, especially Abreu. Just keep him. I know it's strange to think of $28 as a relative bargain, but it really is for someone of Abreu's stature in this format. I might just keep Abreu and Machado and not drop Doolittle. I really like what Richards did last year, but that's a weird injury, and he's a big guy, and I don't know how that's going to play out down the line. And yes, closers aren't safe either, but I don't think you're nuts for holding on to Doolittle. I certainly understand Brett's point about spending a little more for a closer who's only a little bit worse, but that's the only tough decision for me. Abreu and Machado are easy, and then Richards and Doolittle, I think, are really contingent on if you can see who else is being kept in the league. If there are a ton of closers being kept, maybe you do hold on to Doolittle. If everyone's throwing their closers back, maybe you feel okay letting him go too. So I don't know how much scouting you can do of the other league options, but I would look at that before I made a decision.
Yeah, I mean, you seem to... Simone seems to know that there's usually a ton of inflation for hitters. I guess you can kind of look at it historically and see where people are keeping their relievers and try to make the decision that way. You know, in a vacuum, I ascribe to the plan that Brett put forth. I mean, it's just, you know, there's not much, really much that you can add to Abreu, you know, what's been said here. But it's just, he's one of those guys that you pay it, unless it's extreme. Machado and Richards are, you know, I'm definitely keeping Machado, and if you can squeeze in Richards, that I would do that too, and dump Doolittle. If it's one of those things where you feel like you have to keep Doolittle, then I would do that. I think those two are pretty close in value to me, and I understand reliever variability and all that, but the point Brian brings up, you know, knee injury for a big guy, that's something you got to watch out for. So, in a vacuum, it's Abreu, Machado, and Garrett Richards over Doolittle for me.
All right, we need to argue about something, but thankfully, I think this next question will do the trick. The next question comes from Craig's favorite listener, Brady, HB Joker. And he says, has there been a discussion on the merits of Turkey on the podcast before? My opinion, Turkey is good as hell, HB Joker. So we have to make a few distinctions here. Would you gentlemen care to discuss Turkey the cold cut or Turkey the roast first? What would you care to parse first?
Let's talk about Turkey the cold cut, because I feel like there's going to be more there's going to be more disagreement on that.
I don't know. I think there's going to be more disagreement on the other.
All right. Well, let's not disagree about what there's going to be more disagreement on. We'll start with Turkey the cold cut. On a standard scouting scale, Brett, where do you rank Turkey the cold cut?
Turkey the cold cut is a 60, plays up to a 70 with bacon.
Okay, Mal?
It's like a 50 for me. Plays up. I mean, everything plays up with bacon, but you know, it's average. It's solid.
Not a great argument by Brett. You just put a hitter in the court. Craig.
I'll say 55.
That's what I was going to say.
It's fine. Like it's okay. I would generally say 50, but it's like not all, like it's got its benefits of being good for you. It's lean, whatever, and like it doesn't ruin anything. As a cold cut, I think it's a solid one, but you know, it has a lot of flexibility. So that kind of pushed it to a 55 for me.
I'm in agreement there. I would much prefer a turkey-based sandwich than I'd prefer a turkey to ham-based sandwich. We don't have to get that.
Agree.
But yeah.
Wow.
It does depend on the type of ham. I've had some good ass ham, but we'll circle back later.
Probably not.
Okay, let's move on to just roast turkey, the bird of the ilk that you would traditionally eat in America at Thanksgiving. Which apparently all of our listeners are Canadians. Maybe they don't know what Thanksgiving is, but bear with us here.
Canadian Thanksgiving is in October.
Yeah.
Well, they don't. But of what year? We don't even know. Okay, Craig. scouting scale roast turkey.
Courtney Hawkins. It's 3.
Wow, what an idiot, Mal.
That's like a 60, 65 for me. It's up there.
Brett.
I'm gonna make some enemies with this one. I'm gonna put white meat 40, dark meat 65.
Wow.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
That, okay.
I didn't think about
that. You have to differentiate. It's very different grades.
Well, it's like because dark meat has all that natural athleticism, but it's really unrefined, and white meat's a scrapper in there that you know can just.
This is getting uncomfortable.
Cool.
Does the dark meat speak English? That's a big factor.
Don't be shitty, Mal. roast turkey overall, agree with Brett, dark meat's better. Roast turkey overall is a 65 to 70 grade food item.
That's
yes, and if you disagree, you are not having – it's not being made well for you.
Well, I completely think that's a possibility. I don't even eat it at Thanksgiving.
Well, you have like a million pies.
Was it touching a vegetable?
No, I eat pie and cranberry sauce.
Yeah,
raspberry sauce.
See, here's the thing. I think Craig's environment is tainting the opinion because he doesn't need the turkey. It's just pie. Like, he's fine.
I think
sweet potato pie and cranberry raspberry sauce with whipped cream.
Turkey is so much better than sweet potato pie that it's not even funny.
Yeah, see, in Craig's world, Thanksgiving falls during Pie Week, but I think if it was not, it would be better. I think there would be at least eight.
It's just not that I've had good turkey. I agree. Dark meat is it's a positive contributor. I'll give you that. But white meat turkey is just ass.
Craig, can I roast the turkey next time I come to DC? May I roast a turkey for you?
Yeah, you're not going to like how it goes.
I'm very good at this. I don't know why.
No, it's not about you. It's not like you can be a great coach. You can't make the player better. He's maxed out.
There's only one way for this to end. Craig, we are going to get you invited to Canadian Thanksgiving at Enya's house.
Welcome back to episode 37 of Tino. I hope you used that break to determine which condiments you would put on your Enya sandwich. And now, before we move on into our sort of weekly series of positional, what do we call it? What do we call the positional series? Oh, it's the positionals. It's the fantasy positional series. That's what we call it. It's aptly named, much like the Tino podcast handle. Before we get into that discussion and discuss catchers, we are going to talk about Brett's top 50 2014 signees for Dynasty Drafts. We've received a ton of questions about these players over the past really, really months. Even while this last season was still going on, people have been asking us about it. So this list is comes with much aplomb. So Brett, there are keys that, you know, not literally but metaphorically are being handed to you. So you should take them.
Thank you, sir. So This has been in the works for a while. We've had discussions behind the scenes about this, but if you are listening to this, well, whenever you're listening to it, it's up. It's going up on Tuesday. We're recording this Monday night, so we are looking at previews of it, but you will be looking at the real thing. We're going 50 deep here. Only guys that are signed in 2014. So we are not talking about could be signees like Yo Moncada and Jung Ho Kang, Hector Oliveira, any of those guys. Those will be covered in the 2015 list and in the conversations that we have once they actually sign. So before we actually get into the names on the list, my thesis sort of on this draft class is that it's thin at the top and very, very deep in the middle and at the bottom. So I'm curious to know first if you agree with the general philosophy. I mean, you guys know the names involved at both the top and all the way down the list. So I'm going to throw it to Craig. Yes, no, maybe.
I'm going to say yes to the list. No, I think that's fair. We talked a lot, ahead of time, like as you were formulating the list. I won't speak for Ben, but I know we both kind of felt like there was a solid top three and you kind of made it a top four. And I have a little bit of a bigger gap between Tomas Rodon and Castillo and then Schwarber, but I think it's fair to – I mean, I'm okay with them being grouped together. I do think there's a small gap, but it's not as big as the gap between Schwarber and the next grouping of players. But I do think it is a pretty deep group of players, which just lets you know how thin these can be, because there are guys that most people likely won't have heard of, and I think some of the depth kind of is built out of some bigger names that we're not as high on. I mean, like, you know, we're in the mid 40s when you're getting to guys like Cody Medeiros and Jacob Gatewood, who were first round picks, and I might not even have ranked someone like Gatewood myself. But, you know, those are first round picks and worthwhile guys, but, you know, you're lower on them than I think, you know, a lot of people are or in terms of their value in real life. And I think that's right to be lower on them. But I think that kind of builds the depth of the draft a little bit. And fortunately, you know, these last couple of years, we've been the recipients of the benefit that these guys get to get signed and start playing really quickly. And I think that's a difference between knowing a lot about some more of these players, and we're able to see what guys like, you know, third round guys like Brett Honeywell and those guys like come out and dominate and and verify kind of pre-draft reports and or pre-draft helium, and we can feel a little better about adding them to a list like this. Whereas, you know, if they're an August 15th signing, we might not have seen them pitch more than, you know, 15, 20 innings before they're shut down, and then it's harder to place them in a situation like this. So,
yeah, that's a wonderful point. And, you know, as recently as 4 years ago, you would have a much higher correlation between draft slot and where a player would rank on this list. But as we get to see more of these players, you get guys that move up and guys that move down. And, you know, with more playing time comes, you know, a little bit more certainty. I mean, it's all still relatively small samples anyway, even if these guys went out and signed right away and started playing in, you know, the second week of June, some of them started playing that early. It's still less than 3 months of data, but it's way more data than we would usually have. I mean, you'd be here, you'd have a couple of weeks and then reports from instructs, and that's about it.
And I mean, you say 3 months of data, and that's stats, and that's fine, but it's also 3 months of scouting reports and people putting eyes on these guys in
a more competitive environment. Yeah,
you know?
by data, I meant all of the above.
Yeah, but, you know, like getting to see, you know, as small sample as it is, getting to see Schwarber tear up, you know, competition in high A, that's meaningful in terms of scouting, you know, mm-hmm. where he's placed among people who are at least closer to his peer group than he was in college, per se, you know.
Yeah. So let's channel a conversation into that first tier. You know, we talked about this a lot, and I talk about it in the piece. For me, these four are extremely close, and as much as we advise against it, you can certainly make the argument that people should be drafting within this tier based on what they need most for their team. You know, it's really not a philosophy that I would ever advise using as anything more than a tiebreaker, but these guys, but Tomas, Rodon, Castillo, and Schwarber, for me, all are so close that you can use that argument. If you need an arm, you can take Rodon. If you need if you're looking long term, you can take Tomas. If you're looking short term and you're trying to compete in 2015, Castillo is absolutely defensible as a number one pick. There's just you have to, as much as I love Schwarber, you'd have to really squint a little bit harder to see him as the number one pick over these three guys. But I think the talent is there to keep him in the tier. So Ben, do you agree with the general premise that these guys are as close as I am describing here?
Yes, I think the last point you made is the one I agree with most strongly, in that I don't think you can make an argument for Schwarber being first here, whereas you can make an argument for any of the other three players being first. But okay, if you want to include him in the tier, sort of hearkening back to what Craig said, just because I think he probably is closer in value to these three than he is to Hoffman, Nola, and Alex Jackson, which are 5, 6, and 7 on the list. So, you know, I think it's well documented that you are the high man on Schwarber. Craig and I are, I don't think low on him. I think just more in line with industry consensus. But that's, you know, the profile that Schwarber possesses is a good one to hitch your wagon to, because if it clicks, it's going to be special. So I certainly understand you there. And 4 is okay for me. I really don't think you could take him 1. But yeah, the first tier, what you said makes sense to me.
Schwarber's starting to grow on people defensively. You know, it's not that people think he's going to be an everyday catcher, but that 2 to 3 days a week catcher, Evan Gattis type profile is something that's, you know, it's starting to creep up a little bit. You know, and by the same token, you do have to really squint. You have to accept the fact that he's a hard worker, that he's somebody who really puts a lot of work into what he does, and that the Cubs are going to give him every opportunity to stay behind the plate. You know, some of that is internal scouting on their part. Some of that is, yeah, it might just be pumping Bally or whatever. But yeah, I do fall in line with Ben and Craig. I can't really see taking him over any of the other three. But I think that needle's moving up, and I think he's you know, I think perception of him is starting to glow a little bit.
Well, I mean, that's the dream for fantasy, right? I mean, you know, if you own Kyle Schwarber, you don't want him to be the everyday catcher anyway. Not that I think anyone really thinks he will be, but if he's catching, I mean, if you could pick an ideal scenario eligibility-wise for Schwarber, you'd have him catch about once or twice a week, keep the eligibility, and play, you know, 150 games, most of them in the outfield.
Yeah, well, so the thing with Schwarber is there's a few different aspects to it. I mean, first of all, I factor him in as retaining catcher eligibility for at least, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. I think he can get 30 or so games a year. But if what Mao is saying in terms of them giving him every chance to stick behind the plate is true, that's going to slow down his timetable to the majors. So that's
absolutely, yeah.
It's a net positive, but you do give back some in that sense. The other thing I wanted to say was the only I could see taking Schwarber over a guy like Tomas at number one overall in, like, for example, I'm in an NL only league. It's a 10 team league with two catchers. And in this situation, you know, if I'm choosing between Tomas and Schwarber, if I really think he is going to stick a catcher, I might actually find that value to be more than the immediacy of Tomas combined with his third base slash outfield profile. I think that they're going to play him at third base might help him hold that top spot. But I do think, you know, if you think you're going to get 145 games from a catcher with Schwarber's hitting ability, I think that's a defensible number one pick in a NL only, like, two catcher league. That's where I see it. When you're talking about mixed leagues or one catcher leagues, I would revert back to the immediacy. But that's kind of how I see that breakdown.
Fair enough. So that's enough of the first tier. The second tier is sort of interesting, and we alluded to those names before. I think number five and six are very, I think actually all three of them are very close, but the first two are pitchers. That's Jeff Hoffman and Aaron Nola. Craig, I know you're sort of the high guy on Nola. And I think I may be the high guy on Hoffman. So, you know, I guess we'll take the opposite view. Do you agree with both of these two guys being the next two guys off the board? And if so, explain why, assuming you do, explain why you would prefer Nola.
I do. At this point, I'd prefer Nola because of health. He's not coming off of Tommy John surgery. And I mean, Hoffman was a rumored top five pick at one point, and I saw him with ECU when they came to Virginia. It was one start, so I'm not making any huge judgments off that. The stuff was fantastic, and he showed three pitches. And I mean, it's a very intriguing package. But he is coming off an injury, and while that injury recovery usually goes smoothly, you know, it's an added risk. Nola, I think, tends to get overlooked. He was a really good college pitcher, and I was not at all high on him going into the draft because my big concern was, you know, he was kind of a low to mid 90s guy, you know, mainly 90 to 94, touch 96 in college. And my big concern with him was, is he going to hold that velocity throwing every fifth day as opposed to once a week? And, you know, what he showed over last year was that he could do that. Now, if you want to say the question still remains is whether he can do that over a full professional season, I'm with you on that. But, you know, I don't think that risk is substantially bigger than Jeff Hoffman, who's transferring from the same kind of schedule and has the added risk of Tommy John. I'm fine with Hoffman 5 and Nola 6. I think they're really – they should be back to back, and I think these are the right spot for them. So if you, I mean, it's one spot. I'm not going to split hairs over it. But if you wanted to make the argument, I would say, you know, Nola performed really well in terms of transitioning to the majors to a professional setting, and retained his stuff, which that was my big question mark. So that's kind of what's pushed him back up boards for me.
All right, so that leaves sort of, and we'll after this tier, we'll stop kind of going player by player. But brings us to Alex Jackson, who probably has the highest offensive upside, at least as far as non-speed-based hitters go in this entire draft class. And while it's unfortunate he was drafted by the Mariners, because that's obviously not a great place for him to call home, assuming he does call it home eventually. Ben, what do you see Jackson becoming, and is this do you see him behind the two arms that he's in front of? Because I've seen people make the argument for him in front of Hoffman and Nola for, you know, sort of standard hitter versus pitcher reasons.
Yeah, my initial inclination is to have him over Nola, but the fact that he was drafted by the Mariners is not just a big deal to me because Safeco could be his field someday. It's because the Mariners have done a really shitty job of developing hitters for a long time now. And if he stays in the organization and makes it, then he's also in a shitty park. So, I mean, for me, it's just among the worst possible landing spots for him. I think if he had been drafted by an organization, preferably that was better, had a stronger track record of developing hitters, or at least had favorable home park factors, I probably would have him above Nola. But as currently constructed, I think this is the right spot for him. I also don't view him as a particularly fast mover, and I don't mean that as an insult. I just mean that, you know, he's not going to be a high school guy who gets there in 2.5 years. I think you're looking at a standard 3.5-4 year progression for Jackson with good upside. I think probably outfield 2 upside, but that's not so incredible that I'm willing to overlook the fact that Nola could be in the majors late this season or early next season. And I'll also say that after this 7 is where, yes, it's a deep crew, but it starts to get fairly uninspiring for me.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. You have sort of these three guys who are all sort of bunched in like the pretty much the 45 to 55 range in the 101. And then it drops to the number 8 spot. And on the list, the number 8 guy is Brandon Finnegan. But you could make the argument for any of these guys that could keep them off the Dynasty 101 entirely.
I'll say I would have – I guess I'm the low man on Jackson. I don't know if I'd have Jackson in the same grouping as Hoffman and Nola, and I might take Finnegan over him.
Yeah, I would. That's fair. I agree with that.
I think Jackson, the potential I'm not going to argue with. I think Ben, when Ben described his potential, I'm with that. I think he's possibly 5 years to the majors, and that's way too long for me to wait. Even if I'm rebuilding, I think he's an easy 4 year to the majors guy, at best, and then possibly longer, and I'm going to take a guy who's in the majors. And I know Finnegan has his own question marks and tops out as a mid-rotation guy, but he's there now, and I think he can start. I mean, so that definitely colors it, that I'm low on Jackson and high on Finnegan in that sense, but that's an argument I'd be willing to make.
Yeah, and it, when you're talking about 4 or 5 years to the major leagues, I mean, it's not going to be pretty all the time. So it's, you know, even if you're trying to bank on the value or, you know, the ability to trade a guy away, it's, you know, there's going to be a lot of variability with his stock because it's just, you know, it can go up and down given the player profile. There's a lot of ways he can go, and it can go really poorly or it can go really great. And, you know, there's a lot of extreme there.
Yep, there absolutely is. So let's kind of speak to the next sort of groupings in generality. There's really not a whole lot separating, in my opinion, separating essentially the next 12 guys on this list. Do any of you guys want to pick a name in particular, talk about sort of in the rest of the top 20, and sort of either give the argument for or against them if they're either too high or too low?
Don't all rush at once.
Nope, no one wants to do it. So no. That's okay. Thank you for listening to episode 37.
All
Craig, why don't you start?
I don't know. I obviously just made the case for Finnegan, but that's kind of one spot. I'm comfortable with most of these people. I guess I could make the case that I think Nick Gordon should be higher. I love, and it's possibly because of my vociferous love for Forrest Wall that he's as high as he is. Not that you don't like him in his own right, but I think you could. I think I would probably have Gordon above Wall. I do think Gordon sticks at shortstop, and I don't think he's any sort of a shabby hitter in his own right. I would put them together. You have them two spots apart. It's not that big a deal. That is something when I first looked at the list, I kind of was like, I raised an eyebrow at and was like, oh, Wall's in front of Gordon. I guess if you want to tell me that the future environment plays into that with Wall being in Colorado, I can buy into that. Cause I do think that's obviously going to make a fairly big difference, but, I would love to argue for Max Pentecost, who's at 22, a bit higher, but the shoulder injury and him only playing 25 games, really a lot of his value was in how quick he was for the majors. So that kind of hurts that argument.
That's very true.
Yeah. I'll take up, I know this is not going to be super popular with everyone. I would have Tyler Beedy up further, at least ahead of Kyle Freeland, who's a pitcher in Colorado. And I know there's a lot of work to be done for BD, but we just talked about Jackson landing with one of the worst possible orgs. BD landed with one, maybe the best possible org for him. Very strong history of developing pitchers, great home ballpark once he gets there. I understand that not everyone is completely convinced he is a starter, but I think he has the natural tools to be a starter, and he's a better bet to do that in San Francisco than he would have been elsewhere. So for me, having him below, Ortiz, who's quite a bit away, Freeland, who's a pitcher in Colorado who doesn't have huge upside, I would like to see Bead, five or six spots higher, which, again, because, like Brett, like you said, it's not that big of a deal in this group of players, because I'm looking at 14 to 24 and thinking, yeah, okay, like really any order of those guys with a few exceptions I'm not too mad about. I think Wall is a little high. I know you guys love him. I think 15 is aggressive. I think Derek Fisher could be a little higher, but overall I don't have a major issue with any of these.
Yeah, and this, and it really brings the argument where this is a great year to have extra picks and not extra picks at the top. Having a getting someone to throw in a second round draft pick for this year is an extremely wise strategy. It's a wise strategy for a third round pick too, but these players are so interchangeable and they all do carry a good amount of value. So whether you're talking about a guy like Trey Turner or Tyler Kolek who do barely crack the top 10, or moving all the way down to a Tyler Beedy or Luis Ortiz, the gap is not nearly as wide as the numbers make it seem.
Yeah, I don't really have any major issues with the list either. I guess I could, I could make the case for Trey Turner being in the Jeff Hoffman, Aaron Nola, Alex Jackson tier. It's a really smooth athlete at short. He's gonna stay there. He's super coordinated out there. The hit tool, he gets a little bit long in his swing. Kind of casts some doubt into where you think the hit tool is, but he's got the speed to make up for it, and it's going to help the playoff quite a bit. And when you're talking about impact speed at short and, maybe enough hit to not be a complete dead weight in average and actually maybe be something special, I can see where you think the upside and the growth potential is with Trey Turner to, kind of put him in with Jackson, Hoffman, and Nola. Personally, I wouldn't have him over someone like Finnegan or Nola, but I can see them being grouped a little bit closer together. Well, I guess he is grouped with Finnegan, so.
And just going back to Jackson really quick, I had thought of something, so I went and looked it up. So would you guys disagree that Will Myers' career path to the majors is kind of his best? Do you think that's a best-case scenario or close to it?
I think it's close to his best case scenario. Yeah,
You're talking about a guy who was taken as he was a high school catcher, moved out to outfield, that kind of thing. That was kind of why I thought of it.
Yeah, he also was in an organization. I mean, Tampa moves guys notoriously slow, and they're slower to move players than the Mariners are. So it's a slightly different situation. But
that's true.
I
but
very
they
much
also,
see what you're getting at here.
They tend to have immediate production from those guys that they move slowly, whereas a lot of teams promote guys and then let them kind of survive or struggle at the major league level.
We're talking about the Royals, right? Not the Rays here. Just wanna.
No. Well, he was talking about the Rays in terms of holding.
Well, the Royals moved him for a little while, but the Rays sort of stalled him at Triple A. I think that hurt his timetable a little bit.
But that was 3.5 to 4 years, and I think you know that's a and he pretty much everything went right with he had one kind of off year, but the Royals, to their credit, didn't slow him down on that off year. I believe they promoted him in the offseason anyway. So that was the only reason I was kind of that. Like, if you thought I was being dramatic in terms of saying it's a 4 year timetable for Jackson, I thought, you know, that's kind of a he moved pretty quickly for a high school guy, and that was still 3.5 to 4 years. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Well, sure. I mean, if Jackson wins the rookie of the year in his age 22 season, I mean, everyone who took him in the first round of drafts is going to be doing backflips.
Sure. I don't disagree. But I just want to say, like, that's how long, you know, that's a long time to keep a prospect.
Agree.
In your own system.
It is. It's not an abnormal lead time for a prep bat, though.
Agree.
So we'll kind of throw things around a little bit the rest of the draft. We have it's out there up to 50. Who are guys on this list that that you guys would each take earlier than I have listed? We'll go sort of in reverse order from who we've heard from the most. So, Mal, who's someone who, if you were re-ranking this list, would take a decent jump up?
I think Spencer Adams is that guy for me. I think he's got a lot of growth potential as well. And, yeah, that's you got him in the 40 to 41 range, and with the current system stands, and a couple of other guys. You know, that the ranking itself makes sense, but you know, Adams is somebody that I feel pretty comfortable taking a chance on, just given you know his profile and what the White Sox tend to do with pitchers. So that's my guy, Ben.
I would take two guys back to back a little higher, Sean Newcomb and Braxton Davidson at 31 and 32. Not dramatically higher, but I like them both better than Jack Flaherty, who's at 25. Valdequin, you have at 26. I'd probably move each of them up 7 or 8 spots on this ranking, have them closer to the Luis Ortiz, Max Pentecost tier. Especially Newcomb, who I know isn't anything special, but could move fairly quickly and would have favorable contextual factors. So having him behind Mitch Keller seems a bit harsh to me. Craig?
I already mentioned Pentecost. I'd have him at least ahead of Chavis and Hill, who are guys who, again, that's more of a timetable thing. And even with this surgery setting him back a little bit, I think he reaches the majors at least a year or two before them. I might even put him ahead of Freeland. The other guy I mentioned Brent Honeywell earlier. I'd probably take him somewhere in the mid 20s. I think having him in the Flaherty or I don't think I could put him ahead of BD, but I'd have him probably right ahead of Flaherty, who I'm not as high on, but I know I'm one of the few people who's not as high on him. So those are my two names.
All right. So then the opposite question, who would you move down the list? We'll go in reverse order. So Craig, we'll start with you.
I might not have Nick Birdie on my list at all. He's a reliever, and it's nothing against his talent, but I don't care for prospect relievers. I wouldn't put him on a list like this. Some of the honorable mention guys that you have, I would definitely have on the list in favor of a straight up reliever. I guess I actually probably wouldn't. I don't think it's a bad ranking of Newcomb, but as far as he's a college pitcher, and he kind of came up late in the draft, but he's kind of a fastball only guy right now. So I agree he could move fast because the Angels don't really have anyone else, but his secondaries aren't nearly as refined as I'd be looking for in a college pitcher. And so I actually think he could take longer than most college pitchers would, though he might move faster than he probably should because of the Angels system. Ben?
Birdie is really the name that stuck out to me. So
yeah.
I don't know if I have a ton to offer here. I wasn't super familiar with Brent Honeywell, but after talking to you and Craig, I feel better about that. I don't know of anyone who I think should take a big drop. I already mentioned Forrest Wall, but I wouldn't give him a big drop. I know he's higher up on the list. Tyler Kolek at 9 seems aggressive to me.
Yeah.
I think I'd have him farther down, at least next to Tukey or something. I don't see myself taking Kolek, really, or Holmes, who I really like Craig does, but ahead of some college bats in Turner, Zimmer, or Conforto doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah, I'm there with Kolek and Tukey Toussaint being ranked a little bit closer. I don't really have a big drop off either. I wouldn't rank Cody Medeiros, but that's not much of a drop off at all. So
yeah, he's at 46. So
yeah, so it's not a precipitous fall. Birdie was a fucking pull.
All right. Any other final comments on the list before we move on?
How close were you to ranking Justice Sheffield?
Yeah, that's the name I was going to think of.
Honestly, he's interchangeable with any of the pitchers in the sort of back half of the 40s. I mean, anyone from Foster Griffin on down. Griffin, yeah. Medeiros, Reed Foley, Weaver, Sheffield, they're all kind of you could sort of put Stinnett in that category, although I think I'm a little bit lower on Stinnett than that group. But yeah, you could have Sheffield in the top 50. I would absolutely have no issue with that.
I think it's cute you labeled Gatewood a shortstop.
Very cute.
Well, I want to give him a little self-confidence.
He reads us.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
Does he?
No.
Ben got excited.
I think it's adorable that you mentioned Casey Gillespie at all.
You know it's really bad when there's a first baseman taken in the first round and you can't even crack the top 50. You know that is not a popular pick.
Nope. Not even the best baseball in Gillespie. And Connor's not that good.
No.
Nope.
All right.
That's all I got.
Excellent.
I'll give a brief shout out to sure. Gavin LaValle, the fourth rounder who's on the honorable mention list, who is a sort of a scare quote third baseman, and he's a big guy, and I like big guys. So.
That explains a lot.
I was going to say, now I know how you picked Tino. my favorite scouting phrase for big guys comes from Mark Normandin, and it's, you need to keep him away from snacks, is the way that Mark describes guys with big bodies. Big fan of that.
Yeah, it's probably a safe bet with LaValle, but he's got some interesting noise in his bat. But, I'm going to hand things back over now to Ben for our regularly scheduled programming.
Well, this is don't rest too long, Brett. Because
yeah, I was going to say this is just
we're about to go over something else you wrote.
Really quickly, I'm going to ask you a question that you don't have to answer now, but I just want to keep it, you know, just keep it in your head. How the fuck did you get to 50?
What do you mean, how did I get to? Wait, for which list? You have to narrow it down for the top 50 list that we're going over of mine on this podcast.
The catchers. How'd you get to 50 catchers?
Really easily. I had to put honorable mentions in there because I didn't want to leave some of those guys out.
I'm reading those honorable mentions.
I have problems. We should just get through it.
Brett is sick. All right. So for those of us, for those of you who have been listening to Tino for a while now, this is probably one of the first segments we have that is annual, because we did this last year, I think shortly after Tino started. So that's kind of cool. Yeah. So we're going to, from now until the start of the season, basically bring you various dynasty ranking lists by Mr. Sayer, and we are going position by position. So if you check out baseballperspectives.com, you'll see that every week is dedicated to a specific position, and we have every type of ranking you could possibly want. We have rankings just for 2015. We have three-year rankings, dynasty rankings, players to target and to avoid for every position, We have a get to know the position, which sort of gives you the layout of the land in mixed leagues, in AL and NL only leagues, in auction leagues. It's pretty great. And then, of course, we have get to know prospects for every position as well. But on this podcast, we are going to stick to the dynasty rankings because we cannot possibly cover all of those lists. Even though Brett did petition to have Tino move to a daily format, and we just talk about a different list every day from now until the rest of the season, the rest of us sadly vetoed. So, Brett, thank you for handing me the keys. They are still warm from your fatherly embrace. I am going to now give them back to you, and you may guide us through your top 50 Dynasty League catchers.
I appreciate the fact that you called that veto sad. all right, so we'll kind of go through this in slightly less detail than we went through the last list, just because everyone's more familiar with these guys. I'm not even going to talk about the first two names. I don't think there's anyone in the world who would argue that Posey and Lucroy are one and two on any sort of current or long-term catcher list.
JP might.
Well, maybe.
Wow.
Oh, come on. I've been saving that all podcast.
You have been. Yeah. So we're going to go to number three. There are a lot of different directions you can go in here. You can make the argument for Yadier Molina if you think he will bounce back fine and continue to have a couple of seasons of really high-end performance. You can make the argument for Salvador Perez, who's the youngest guy in the top 10, I believe. You can make the argument for Yan Gomes if you think he'll keep all of this up. Or you can make the argument for the guy that I put number three on this list, and that is Devin Mesoraco. So who disagrees with Mesoraco at three in general? Anybody?
Me.
So who would you have at three, Craig?
I would have Gomes, I think.
All right. Anyone else, or is that...
Well, it's hard to argue with that.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I didn't buy into Gomes last offseason. Ben, you just obviously wrote about this. But... he's done it for almost two seasons now. Like you said in your article today, Ben, like you look at his numbers and it's like, where is he overperforming? I don't think he is. Like, I don't think he's coming back to earth. I think this is who he is.
Yes. The only league format in which I advised not drafting Gomes is if the only offensive category you count is walks.
Yeah. Which, I mean, like, you know, since he hits for a decent average, that's actually a bonus in a lot of leagues because his average carries a little more weight.
Well, it's a bonus if he keeps it up. If he hits sure. 255, it's not so useful.
255 for a catcher is actually pretty okay.
Yeah,
that's not going to, but 255 if for baseball is not good. So any additional at-bats at a 255 clip is going to lower your team's average.
I think so. I mean, in standard 12 teams.
I'm going to look up the league average. I think 255 is above league average.
You'd have to do it for like the individual leagues. Yeah, you'd have to do it for fantasy leagues.
Yeah,
well, it depends on. Okay, then it depends on the depth of the league, but yeah.
Yeah, okay. For a mixed league, midpoint for batting average is about 265 these days.
I don't think Gomes has given us a lot of indication he's going to hit 255.
Oh, I'm not saying he's necessarily going to. I'm just saying if he does, it's not as helpful. It's not like he's a 300 hitter who gets a lot of at bats. There's a lot of variability there.
Yeah.
I mean, he hit what, 278 this year, and I think that's pretty much the high end of what we can expect.
He hit 294 the year before. I mean, I don't know if 278 is really the high end. I agree, it's more in line with what I'm expecting forward, but I think
more
he's a bit. Yeah, he's got a better bet to hit 280 than 250, I think.
All right, so that's fair. So
yeah, I agree with all of that.
Yeah, I have Gomes at seven. I'm admittedly not that high on him. I believe he is a solid option, but if to be perfectly honest, if I'm going to go with a solid option, I'm probably still going to take Yadi over him.
It's not crazy.
I mean, in the short term, I'm fine with Yadi. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think catcher is one of those positions where it's harder to project out many years into the future with catchers than it is with other positions, which is why which is why with some other positions in the series that we'll see, you know, you have prospects sort of cracking the top 10. You know, the top prospect on this list is down at 15, and that's where Schwarber is. So it's the whole position as a whole in dynasty leagues is more now dependent than future dependent, just because catchers tend to have the shorter shelf lives of position players for fantasy.
Yeah, and I mean, I certainly don't mind weighing the present in terms of Yachty or someone like that a little heavier, but you know, when you're talking about a Yan Gomes or someone like that, he's also now and has a little bit of a longer shelf life in that sense, right? So,
yep,
that would be my case for Gomes, but I mean, Mesoraco to me is, I think, like you said, in the kind of 3 through 7 grouping, you can mix them up a decent amount. I'm lower on Sal Perez than you are. I think they ride him way too hard, which the at bats are great, but I think it really does take a toll on his overall numbers. So
yeah, it's definitely a concern. But I mean, to go back to the point before, three through seven is a very it's a very tight tier. I mean, I separated out Gomes in the write up just because I had a little bit more to say about him, but he's essentially in the tier. There's really not that much of a difference between Mesoraco and Gomes.
Just to illustrate that point for listeners, I did the 3-year catcher rankings, and my names 3 through 7 were in a different order, but they were exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could sort of make that argument for everyone. I mean, I took, you know, in the target piece, I took Brian McCann, and I think that his ranking at number 4 is probably high, probably higher than most people would have him, but it's really personal preference. I mean, these guys are very tight.
Yep.
And then you sort of get into the more fun upside guys. You get into, you know, eight is Derek Norris, 9 is Travis d'Arnaud. You don't have to go much further to get to Ismani Grandal, Wilson Ramos, and then a whole bunch of prospects who have some pretty high ceiling. So I'm curious to get your guys' thoughts on sort of you know, a guy who has more upside in your opinion than the ranking gives him credit for. We'll start with Ben, if there's anyone.
I don't know if there's more upside than the ranking gives him credit for. It's not hard for me to see Grandal rating a little higher here. I liked him as a bit of a breakout candidate even before he was traded to the Dodgers, so you can imagine I like him even better now, but I have a hard time justifying moving him ahead of anyone. I just think that maybe, I don't know, I think this tier is also sort of close, like 8 through 14. Once again, I think I had mostly the same names except for Evan Gaddis because of eligibility reasons in a 3-year ranking. So actually, we can talk about Gaddis. He's not going to be a catcher in fantasy leagues after this season. So talk about your ranking of 10. That seems pretty aggressive. Do you think he's going to be an OF3 starting in 2016?
I think he certainly could be. And I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that he ends up maintaining his catcher eligibility for another year. I think it's more likely that he ends it, but it's not impossible. It's not like a Joe Mauer situation where they came out and said that he's not going to play catcher and there's a health reason why he's not going to play catcher. I mean, Christian Bethencourt could be just fucking terrible, and you know, Gaddis and Przinski could share time and he could end up back in AAA. That's a very, you know, it's
oh
a very
God. Just think about that defensive backstop tandem.
Przinski,
I know, it's
Gaddis.
it's pretty special.
So what I mean, my argument for keeping Gaddis that high is less that he'll retain eligibility this season. I don't think he will get like 20 starts or whatever it is, depending on your league. But I do think he's someone who could pick it up in season, year in and year out, because that threshold is much lower. And depending on if he sticks with the Braves or not, I think a lot of leagues, it's like 5 games in season.
Yep.
And I think he could definitely reach that. And so, well, he's never going to enter the year as a catcher eligibility guy. Like you could, you know, and you might not get it until June, but I think he'll pick it up, you know, now and again, at least.
Yeah. And I think that's fair. I think he absolutely has 25 homer potential in the outfield, and even at a 250 average, which I think is reasonable. In this environment, that puts him pretty close to outfield three status, even if the power doesn't tick up with more playing time. So he's going to be valuable as an outfielder in mixed leagues. He's not going to be a star or anything, but he's not going to just drop off the planet once he loses the eligibility. But sticking in the queue, just to check in on this. I mean, Craig, we're sort of the co-captains of the Derek Norris fan club. His second half was terrible in 2014. Are we anchoring here?
I think eight is aggressive.
Yes.
I am concerned. I know Oakland is a tough place to hit. Petco is also a tough place to hit. I think he was above his head in the first half, and while I was relishing, you know, being right in that sense, I think he's better than he was in the second half, obviously. I just don't think the overall value is going to be great, and I'd rather take a risk on some of these other guys. I think I'd be more comfortable with Norris near, you know, Wieters or someone like that. In terms of answering the question you kind of led out with on guys that we think give a little more value, I might have Wilson Ramos towards the front of this group. I know the health is a big issue, but talent-wise, I mean, I think he could crack that, like, top seven ranking if he could ever put together a full season. So he's a guy I think could return more value. And we can't predict those, but and the safe bet is that he will miss time due to injury, but he's someone I'm still targeting in terms of a value play in general.
Fair enough. Matt, you have anyone to discuss?
No, I talked about Wieters enough on Flag Fly Forever, so that's, you know, I can see kind of jumping him up a little bit, but there are a lot of question marks surrounding him. I know he's got offensive pedigree in his background. I mean, we kind of covered that. So that's kind of the guy that I'm keeping close tabs on. But what's the over under on Wilson Ramos games? Is it 88? Do you think he plays over 88, Craig? Is Craig dead? Sorry.
I don't know. I'm high on him. No, I'm high on him. I think he can get to 100, but I think I'm extremely optimistic. I think something in the 80 game range is probably a lot.
Well, in a, you know, to be perfectly fair, in a, you know, in a 10 or 12 team one catcher league, Ramos becomes more attractive just because, you know, some of these other guys are going to be available as free agents for when he gets hurt. So if you have Ramos for, you know, 90 games and you have, I don't know, someone a little bit further down this list, like a Miguel Montero or even like a Deanna Navarro for the other, you know, 60 games, those stats together it probably makes a pretty good catcher. As you get into sort of a deeper league, it becomes a more daunting proposition, especially if you get into a two-catcher format. But, I mean, the risk is clearly there, but the talent is there too. It's just a matter of risk preference with Ramos.
Right. I agree.
So moving further down the list, I mean, the list has some really interesting prospects and some guys who could perform in the current year, some guys who, you know, could, you know, recapture some of their either prospect form or previous year form. But, you know, from the sort of 15 spot down, who are you guys looking at as potential bargains? Even if you agree with where they are on this list, who are you guys looking for if you're trying to rebuild value for the upcoming season? Craig, what about you?
The names that I mean, Montero is 16. I think he's one who could easily bounce back and provide substantial value. I've kind of been high on him the last couple of years, and that hasn't gone swimmingly. But I do think he's still a bounce back guy. I think Pinto, you know, if he gets playing time, I think he can really hit. They seem intent on not giving him playing time, so that's kind of the tough one for me. And another playing time guy is going to be Deonor Navarro. I mean, he's got Russell Martin, in his way, and I don't think they're planning on featuring him at DH. But he was a nice little player last year, especially in only leagues or deeper leagues. And I think, you know, it's a shame, kind of, because I think there's fantasy value to be had when, you know, you're potentially seeing guys like Josh Bagley start in the majors, and we can't get Deonor Navarro regular at bats.
Yeah, Pinto is a great name. I just traded a third round pick for him in TDGX. Even if the ghost of Kurt Suzuki continues to haunt him for most of this year, I just think, at least by the end of year, headed into 2016, he's going to be logging semi-regular time in the majors, and I agree with you that he can really hit. And then another playing time guy is Andrew Susek with the Giants. You know, maybe if Posey or Belt gets hurt, we see a lot of him, but as it is right now, he's potentially a top 20 fantasy catcher who is stuck behind the number one fantasy catcher, so that sucks for our purposes. But we should hope for a Susek trade, honestly, because he'd be pretty interesting, especially in a half-decent ballpark.
Yeah, well, not in Tampa, where he may be rumored towards at the moment, but yeah, he's definitely a guy who could move up with a movement in team. I mean, the other guy who's on the list who I will sort of half implore people not to forget about is Wellington Castillo. I still think there's enough talent in the bat that he could be. He could be a, you know, sort of startable mixed league catcher in you know, non-shallow formats if he could just kind of get a fresh start from Chicago. I mean, they've clearly turned the page. They've moved on to Miguel Montero, but I still think there's lingering talent there that's worth not forgetting about.
I would have loved to see Castillo go to Colorado instead of someone like Nick Hundley.
That would have been so awesome.
Or Navarro to Colorado would have been fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So we'll, you know, the list gets rather unexciting, as you can tell if you're reading it. But anyone in sort of the 30 to 50 range that jumps out as someone who could really move up this list for next year?
While we're making fake trades to Colorado, let's put Tulo in New York and send Plawecki over there. you know, that would be an amazing trade for him fantasy value wise. He's a really good hitter, and I think he's a tier, like he's a first division catcher. But I don't think he's better than Travis d'Arnaud. So, you know, power when he plays, I guess, whenever the inevitable injury comes for d'Arnaud. But I would love to see him in a place where he could get regular playing time. I think he's a guy that stuck out to me in that range.
Yeah. Matt, what about you?
Plawecki's a really good name. I'm not really a big fan of a lot of people on the back half. Actually, I'm a little bit more negative on a couple of guys. Like, I don't think Pete O'Brien's going to stick at catcher. I think he's probably going to disappear from this list pretty quick. You know, Hundley's a guy that we talked about, and yeah, I mean, Colorado's going to help him a little bit, but there's a freaking catcher logjam there, and you know, it's I'm not with it. You know, you guys are turning me around on Reese McGuire, though. I'm willing to allow a little bit more upwards variability on him. So I think he can move up as well with Plawecki. But this is quite the back half of the list right here, man.
Yeah. Welcome to Team Reese's Pieces, Mal. Glad to have you on board.
So, Ben, you have a name or
So not quite in the 30s, but I think because the team around him got a lot worse, that John Jaso could be in line for a decent amount of playing time this year. And he's certainly nothing special, but, you know, in 16-team leagues, he's a guy where if your primary catcher gets hurt and you need someone halfway through the season, he could be usable in spurts. So that qualifies as exciting for me on the back half of this list in terms of guys we haven't talked about yet, is maybe you can use him in a 16-team league for a month.
Sounds good. The one name I am going to throw out there is, well, shockingly for you guys, it's not Jackson Reitz, although you do know that I appreciate a good Jackson Reitz. The guy I want to talk about really quickly is Luis Torrens of the Yankees. He was pretty good in his short season debut with Staten Island last year. He is still going to be 18 when the season starts and could potentially jump all the way to low A to start the season. It's not out of the realm of possibility. He has a defensive chops to stick at the position, and he has the hit and power projections to be a name that you want to pay attention to in fantasy leagues. He, you know, he's not going to be a monster with the bat or anything, but you don't have to be in fantasy leagues. So he's someone who I think could make a pretty sizable jump in the current year. I think you could, if things go well, you could see him in the 20s next year.
I just wanted a couple things on prospects specifically. I think JT Realmuto belongs on this list in some form. I know Hundley is with the Rockies, but Hundley is terrible and probably doesn't need to be on a dynasty list in any capacity, because I don't think anyone's ever keeping Nick Hundley. The other guys in the 30s, I have to mention Francisco Mejia. I mean, he's like potentially the next Jorge Alfaro in terms of like really toolsy catchers. He doesn't quite have Alfaro's athleticism and speed, but outside of that, I mean, he could be an above average power, above average hit tool guy. And he's just reaching the full season ball. And I think if he has a strong season there, he could absolutely fly up this list. And the last thing I want to talk about, I was actually really surprised. You have Alfaro and Schwarber ahead of Swihart. That really surprised me. Can you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. If this was not a fantasy list, I would have Swihart ahead of both of them. I think Swihart is a great player, but I think he's a less dynamic fantasy option.
Okay.
That's definitely true. It's just an interesting,
yes. Yeah.
It's an interesting exercise to me in valuing upside over probability, because Schwarber is really not a lock to stay a catcher, and Alfaro is really not a lock to hit, whereas Swihart is pretty much a lock to do both those things, even if not immediately. I think in the long run, people don't really doubt his hit tool, and he's certainly a catcher, so... It's interesting to me. I don't agree with it, but I get it.
Yeah, they're also very, very close. I mean, they're very close, especially Alfaro and Swihart. I mean, we don't need to go back into Schwarber, but whether you think he retains catcher eligibility for however long is nice, but if he hits, it's almost irrelevant. I mean, I think he's going to hit. I think he's going to hit really well. So,
yeah, I guess that was just my like long way of saying I would have Swarhart as the top prospect.
That's fair. That is fair. He is. You can add as absolutely a good argument that you can make.
That was a hell of a slow no.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm surprised that Carlos Ruiz made this list at 31, but Enya's not even an honorable mention.
That was an oversight on my half.
Welcome back to episode 37 of Tino. As always, let's send you out with a little housekeeping. Right now, please check out all the tremendous fantasy content we are publishing on a daily basis over at BP. Regardless of what format you're playing or what your needs are, we are here for you. Please rate and review us on iTunes. Every rating and every review helps us tremendously, and we love reading your comments. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at Tino Podcast and get in touch with us through email at tinopodcast@gmail.com. You can find Brett at Dynasty Guru. You can find Mauricio at mrubio52. You can find Craig at CD. That's CD as in condom describer, Goldstein. And you can find me at Ben Carsley. Thank you for listening and have a good night.
Well, it's great for condom describer.
You hit the eject button on that motherfucker real quick.
Yeah. Brett's moving on.
Wow.
I thought that was smooth.
No, it was smooth. Yeah. It was definitely smooth.
It was good.
I just thought we were going to keep riffing for a little bit, and we were not. Mm-hmm. Oh, Dad, turn the fucking car around. We were all
turkey to ham?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On a sandwich, yes.
Wait. What kind of ham?
See, this is fuck. It's fair to
what kind of turkey? Like I
okay.
See, I think
like...
turkey's a more uniform flavor throughout the sandwich meat.
That is definitely okay. True.
That's
ham
true.
Varies.
I agree with that.
Ham varies. Okay, well, like honey baked ham versus turkey, I'm going ham.
Yeah, if you're talking like a spiral ham,
yeah.
No.
That's good shit.
Oh,
yeah.
I hate. Oh no!
Well, yeah, but spiral ham
right now.
Spiral ham on a breakfast sandwich.
Fine.
Oh, that's
fine.
That's tremendous.
Right, now you're talking my language.
Fine. Yeah. That's okay. Well, can we end on that before the blood flows? That's fine.
Can we agree that like lunch meat chicken is weird?
Yeah, it's terrible.
I don't like the
fucking buy
chicken.
Turkey. Why are you buying chicken if there's turkey next to it?
Because chicken breast is supposed to be better for you.
I'm just saying, like it's out there, and I don't like it.